This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Here. Now we're going to get to Bill, who is joined by Megan Heiss and Seamus Cook to talk about the People's Budget Project. But they also are going to be talking about actions that you should think about coming to resist austerity and build voice around alternatives to it.
Austerity organizing.
Hi, Megan Heiss and Seamus Cook of the People's Budget Project. Welcome to KBOO, and why don't you introduce yourself?
Well, I'm Seamus Cook. I'm a social worker here in Portland, and I'm a volunteer for the People's Budget Project.
And I'm Megan Heiss with Solidarity Against Austerity, and we're together, we are organizing around the 2013-14 city budget.
Tell us about the People's Budget Project. Why did you form? Who's involved? How you have operated and what your focus is?
Well, we came into existence last year, kind of mid-Occupy, in protest of last year's city budget cuts. And we came together as a way to educate folks about the budget and to put forth alternatives.
And Solidarity Against Austerity really emerges from the anti-austerity organizing that was going on in the fall. And we've continued to bring people together with a message that we don't want to fight over crumbs. There's enough for everyone. And our focus right now is the City of Portland budget.
Who's involved? How well have you done both in building a coalition of organizations and, in fact, finding, I suppose, people within those organizations, but also individuals who identify and get affiliated with you?
Well, that has been our focus, trying to get people who are affected by the cuts together in a unified struggle against these cuts. So students, city workers, anyone who's affected by the cuts, housing justice people, that's kind of our goal, is to get a coalition of people together in a kind of a powerful coalition to stop this.
And it really forms itself because so many people are affected by these cuts because they're so widely and deeply felt that stakeholders are self-organizing to be active and be vocal at these budget hearings. And we are trying to put forward a message that we need to unite and not just fight for our own individual programs, but fight collectively to stop austerity and put revenue on the table.
Yeah, that's sometimes very hard. The well-positioned organizations who have real sort of social power and lots of people sometimes are able to make sure that they aren't cut, but all those others, including the poorest of the poor, the pain gets transferred down to them. How well are you doing at keeping your coalition together?
Well, I would say we're pretty successful. At the last hearing, we had over 400 people there, and we had a lot of people wearing stickers and holding signs with our messaging, which is essentially, you know, no cuts, no layoffs, raise revenue, use the reserves that the city has to cover the cuts, and have a new strategy to avoid these cuts next time.
Mm-hmm. Not just cuts. I know, reading some of your material, that the city budget includes all sorts of juicy goodies for developers and companies, and tax breaks, and not just tax break. Very exciting preferential treatment, railroad sidings built. They do everything they can. And, of course, in a world of mobile capital, they want to keep companies here. It's sort of shadowing everything. Some of them are really useless and should be ended.
That's the crux of the campaign, really, is this is about priorities. And this is our city, and we want our revenue to go towards funding services that everyone can use instead of giving money to corporations via subsidies and tax credits or whatever else, regressive tax policies. We want a kind of a people-centered, a people's budget approach to our budget.
That's true. And there's more. What we know is that inside the city of Portland alone, there's nearly a $1 billion backlog in road maintenance. In the park system, we have nearly a $600 million backlog. It's worse when we get into our water and sewer system. Right now, the city could be putting Portland to work in our productive infrastructure. These are green jobs. This is what our community needs to thrive. And we want to see the city invest in that, in jobs and services for the people.
I'm sure you're asked by people, where are those resources going to come from?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And what's really interesting is that every time there's a city budget with a deficit, the discussion is so narrow and so undemocratic. And that's one of our main points. is that there's three options really to every time there's a deficit. We can raise revenue, we can make cuts, or we can use reserve funds. And all we hear from the city every time is we have to make cuts, we have to make cuts. There's no discussion at all publicly about how we would go about raising revenue, how we would go about avoiding the cuts.
I know you have a list of ways that revenue can be, in fact, raised.
Well, there's so many options. And, I mean, for instance, we could have a Multnomah County income tax. That's progressive. You know, there's wealthy people in Portland who are doing quite well. They could be taxed a little higher to pay for these services.
And there's a precedent for that because in 2003, voters passed a Multnomah County income tax. Another example is the Measure 6667 campaign.
And we can make property taxes more progressive. Working people who own a home, they pay a lot of property taxes. We can make it more progressive and have those with nicer homes, the wealthy, pay higher property taxes. There's many options.
But what we need right now is leadership to fix Oregon's broken tax structure and generate real reform that can provide relief to working families who are paying more than their fair share and generate the resources to fund our schools and to fund our municipal governments.
Mm-hmm. And city council, all of city council is very, very quiet over any discussion of alternatives. It's really striking. Nothing in the papers about that.
I wonder if they even do it in their committees, or are they even afraid to think about such a prospect where many of their best friends, in fact, have to pay a little bit more of their 6- and 7-figure salaries.
You know, you're right. I think what's interesting is this used to be a kind of a right-wing policy. Austerity was the Republicans, and now we have the Democrats on board entirely with austerity. City Council is all Democrats, right?
On the state, they're all liberals.
On the state level, likewise, there's majority Democrats who are doing a state austerity budget. So this is, you know, both parties are pro-austerity.
Yeah, they're all afraid that Intel and Nike will at some point decide that these people have to go and unite with Fred Meyer and the Oregonian to point out that these people are unfriendly to business and these candidates and are costing Oregon jobs and are threatening the future of our children. That is really the death sentence for politicians.
Well, if you'll let me comment on that, actually.
Sure.
I was present for the mayor's press conference on Tuesday when he made his proposed budget announcements on how he was going to deal with the $21 million shortfall in the general fund and provide rate relief, you know, folks who pay water and sewer bills. And there was actually a reporter who stood up and asked a question, why a cuts-only budget? What are you doing about revenue? Which is a coup. I mean, I think that our organizing in Portland has started to put these questions on the map. His answer was, we're exiting a massive recession. Now is not the time to raise taxes. Our business community is just now getting on its feet.
So now is the time for layoffs and cuts to social services that affect poor people is kind of the answer. That's the reality.
And we're talking, let's get into brass tacks. We're talking 182 layoffs among full-time workers at the city, 144 of which are union members. We're talking about cuts to mental health services, community centers, funding for parks and infrastructure maintenance, SUN after-school programs, which are extremely popular, youth employment services, and so much more. I mean, that is the cost. And so we're saying instead of making these painful cuts, there are lots of ways to balance the budget without laying off workers and cutting vital programs. For instance, using less than 1/4 of the city's surplus in the internal service funds would fill this year's budget gap. And the city could also end tax breaks that only benefit the wealthy without raising a single tax on average working people.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Seamus Cook and Megan Heiss, the People's Budget Project, who have been intervening in the in budget hearings and making life really much more difficult for them. You just heard from Megan saying that, in fact, the message is getting out. Let's switch gears a little bit. Your goal is not just to save services, to save what's really sort of life-giving for many poor people and working people who are going to be losing jobs. It's a real disaster in some ways for the city not to tax the rich and to lay off ordinary people. It's not even good for business. The rich have so much they don't have time to spend it. In some ways, it goes to offshore banks, it goes to other investments, it goes to third homes, whatever it goes to, yachts, fourth cars, the kids' therapy. It's not easy being rich. They got lots of troubles. Your goal is not just to stop cuts and even improve services. It seems to me your goal also is to educate that there really are alternatives, and especially it seems to me to build movements to, in fact, really empower people and to give people a sense of all of those alternatives. How well do you think you're doing that?
We've tried to do a lot of outreach to different community groups affected by the cuts, labor groups. Really, part of our strategy is to get all these people in the same room, you know, at city council, and to feel the power you have when you have hundreds of people getting rowdy and rejecting these policies. It's really empowering, and I think as far as movement building goes, that's how you build a strong movement. You have a coalition, a broad-based coalition of working people who kind of are united in a goal that we can work together on.
You know, I can't wait until the movement grows too big to hold those meetings in City Hall, in the council chambers, and they have to rent the Coliseum and then the Rose Garden and then the Rose Bowl to bring it here.
Well, you know, I'll bet you on May 16th, we will have too many people to fit in City Council, so we'll be out in the streets as well as in City Council. And you're right, they could use a bigger place for us to protest.
Well, let's hope it happens really soon.
I mean, I think on the movement building question, one of the most important things we can be doing is exposing the agenda, because time and again we are told we have to make these cuts, there's no money, there's no alternative, but there's this whole other side of the story that we're never told. In fact, USPIRG rated the city of Portland, graded them a D- in fiscal transparency. We're not given the information that we need to make the decisions about...
Decisions about how the budget works and how we can spend our money. Every community budget form, the mayor says, he puts forth a narrative that says we have to make cuts because there is a deficit. That's not true. They're framing these budget hearings, these community-led budget hearings, in a way that's very pro-1% and doesn't give people the information they need to make an educated decision. So that's where we come in, is try to educate folks by having speakers at these forums, flyers, signs, and say, you know what, city council's not being honest. There are alternatives to these cuts.
Well, you're going to all of the local dog and pony shows then, and speaking there as well. It's not just the budget hearings, it's any of the sort of the public events that accompany the budget.
Well, yeah, and these community budget hearings, they are dog and pony shows. You know, they're kind of set up to put forth an agenda, and that's why we are transforming them to meet the needs of the community.
Well, one sign of success is going to be when they decide that the community meetings are not an effective means of communicating and terminate them. But as long as they last, it seems to me that all of those things are really wonderful, actually. At least local politics does offer so many opportunities, right, for people to get together, see one another.
And after our presence at the last budget hearing on April 11th, the city budget office added three more public hearings for public comment on this budget.
Oh, yes. And that was demanded, I gather, by...
Well, they haven't been able to create a space where everyone is able to speak. So at the end of every budget hearing, there's still a line of folks in the queue waiting to testify about their programs.
What time do they start generally?
They generally start at 6:30, and people show up to sign up at 5:30. Uh-huh. So people will be there until 9:30 and still want to speak. Well, so they've added three more hearings.
This is a wonderful show, isn't it, in some ways? It must be very exciting. I remember trying to build events, and if we got 23 people, it would be so much better than 14 or 6. There have been embarrassments in all of our lives, I guess, but in terms of that. It must be great to feel all of that energy flooding into the city hall.
It is, and we thought there was potential for this as we started the campaign, and initially there was only a couple of us, but now it's kind of growing, and people are realizing that this is an issue that a lot of people can get behind. A lot of folks are affected by this, and they want to save their programs, and this is a way for them to come together and do that.
You know, early in the interview, we talked about bringing so many groups and people together, but not just to contend for their own program and its significance and need, but to, in fact, support one another. That's always, you know, these coalitions, they always break down. Even the unions who start out fighting for themselves, often the teachers' union, they often disappoint others in the coalition and seek funding for the schools, and they also have huge amounts of parent support. It's very tempting for them, and they wind up doing it, not all the time.
Bill, I think the point is they have us in the scarcity mentality where this budget is a zero-sum game. There's never enough to go around, and this is how they keep us divided. And that's why the theme for our protest in front of City Hall on May 16th is it's time to bake a bigger pie. We don't want to fight over crumbs anymore. We refuse to choose between libraries and sun schools. We want it all.
That's been a big barrier for us, is overcoming that divided mentality where each group kind of advocates for their own program. And it's a shift of thinking for them to see, to realize that we're stronger together. We don't have to fight for little crumbs. If we're united in this campaign, we don't have to be fearful as individuals.
I suppose also each of them has to have an opportunity to show that they have political strength too, and you have to be careful that this, in disappointing us. I guess it will always wind up to be a, hopefully in a lesser and lesser degree, a competition and much more a united action.
That's the goal, absolutely.
And we definitely saw that on April 11th when we had 100 folks wearing red T-shirts that said Community and City Workers United.
And hundreds more wearing stickers and holding signs that we made that said, like, raise revenue, not unemployment, tax the rich, you know, alternatives to these cuts. And we hope to keep pushing that message.
You know, it sounds, I'm getting excited, actually. It sounds really heartening. And that, in fact, with that message, we need a decent state that make that, for so many reasons. I mean, public services. We need public services of so many kinds. And there is so much wealth out there. If working people realize that, and if they could just get together, which is often very difficult, and people are working all the time and trying to stay there, keep their heads above water, it seems to me that that would create a force that would really be quite invincible once it began rolling.
Well, we saw in Europe, austerity was an issue that brought together hundreds of thousands of people, and it remains a powerful social movement. And now it's coming to the U.S. in different forms, a national, city, state level, and it creates the same kind of dynamic where we can reach out to other groups to form a very powerful movement. So hopefully this is just the beginning.
Oh, but that's a great end for our interview. before we end, though,
we should give the details of the event.
Yeah, let's do the details.
Okay. So join us Thursday, May 16th to send the message. It's time to bake a bigger pie. No cuts, raise revenue. We're going to have a people's potluck at 5 p.m. in front of City Hall. And we're really encouraging people to bring food. So this is going to be a long evening. We're going to be staying in City Hall until everyone gets a chance to speak. But also pies. There's going to be a pie contest and some theater around the theme of baking a bigger pie. So definitely check that out. And if you're good at baking, we need you. This is a fabulous way to contribute to the cause. And then the City Budget Forum will begin at 6:30, and it's supposed to end at 8:30, but it will probably go till 9:30. If you want to testify, you need to sign up as early as possible. We encourage folks to get there at 5. So come to the potluck, sign in, and then join us outside. It's going to be a good time.
Thanks, Megan Heiss and Seamus Cook.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
If you just tuned in, I'm Joe Clement, your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Before that was a musical mashup of Nine Inch Nails' Head Like a Hole and a more recent pop tune called Call Me Maybe. Before that, we also heard Bill Resnick talking with Megan Heiss and Seamus Cook about the People's Budget Project. KBOO listeners who are interested in what Megan and Seamus are saying about resisting local austerity cuts and showing our resilience as self-organizing communities are also highly encouraged to attend the next KBOO board meeting on the evening of the 28th here at KBOO at Southeast 8th Kitty Corner from City Bikes or 20 Southeast 8th. The struggle against neoliberalism, austerity, and autocracy on those speaking on behalf of money is more pervasive than just the national scene, and your participation is necessary to keep KBOO a community institution. Now we turn to book mole Larry Bolden. He reviews Elizabeth Strout's new novel, The Burgess Boys.
Good morning. I've often wondered what it must be like for a writer to suddenly, unexpectedly have a book explode into a bestseller and prize winner. Wonderful, no doubt, for the moment. But what about when she returns to the hard work of writing another book? We know in retrospect that it had a paralyzing effect on J.D. Salinger when Catcher in the Rye zoomed to fame, and the success of Ralph Ellison's The Invisible Man seems to have had a similar effect on his subsequent writing. Elizabeth Strout cannot have expected her little book Olive Kitteridge to become a bestseller, let alone win a Pulitzer, but her success has not led to anxious inactivity. Her 2013 novel, The Burgess Boys, is a wonderful book, told in the same straightforward and simple way as her earlier works. Most of the novel is set in a small town in Maine, Shirley Falls, and is about people who live quite ordinary lives. Like the great short story writer Alice Munro, Strout seems intent on showing her readers that what appear from the outside to be quite ordinary lives are, viewed from inside and through the eyes of a compassionate and wise storyteller, quite extraordinary. As the title tells us, the story revolves around two boys become men, Jim and Bob, the Burgess Boys. Jim has become both rich and famous, first as a small-town prosecuting attorney, then as a defense attorney who takes on the case of a famous rock star accused of murder, and finally as a member of a prestigious New York law firm that specializes, in Jim's words, in white-collar crime. Bob, the younger brother, is a legal aid attorney who lives in the shadow of Jim's fame, idolizing his older brother, but verbally and emotionally abused and belittled by him. Of the three Burgess children, only Bob's twin sister Susan has remained in Shirley Falls, and it is the thoughtless and silly act of her high school-age son Zach that brings the Burgess boys back to Maine and to a confrontation with a tragic accident from their own past that left them fatherless and mired in guilt. To me, what shines forth in this novel is Strout's compassion and moral insight, not only in her understanding of the Burgess children and the past that unites them, but her understanding of how small towns in America have suffered from economic downturns and the flight of young people from such towns to the big cities. Add to this flight a rather sudden influx of displaced people from a different culture, and the story begins to take shape. The displaced people in this case are Somalis, driven out of their own country by wars, and then escaped from camps that are as or more dangerous than the country they have fled, and finally to this and other small American towns where they huddle together for safety. The reader can hear Strout wondering about how odd and frightening it must be for people who, for the most part, don't speak the language, whose dress and diet and lifestyle are radically different from those of the people they are quite suddenly thrown into daily contact with. Difficult certainly for the immigrants, but difficult also for the townspeople who find these strangers in their midst who both desire and shun assimilation. The silly and senseless act that forces a kind of showdown in this little Maine town is Zach's prank of throwing a frozen pig's head into the makeshift mosque the Somalis use for community prayer. Zach is so ignorant of the ways and culture of the Somalis that have flooded his little town that he doesn't even understand the significance for them of the pig's head. Why did he choose a pig's head? Because, he explains to his attorney uncles, there were no cow or a sheep's head at the slaughterhouse where his friend works and from which he stole the head. He had meant at first to use the head in a Halloween prank, but various complications have led to an alternative act that, quite apart from his intentions, have sinister implications and draw national, even international, scrutiny and serious charges of a hate crime. Although the plot could have been treated in sensational ways, and in other hands the novel could have been layered with mystery and violence, I was not surprised that Strout reins in the sensationalism. She is what I call a quiet writer, concerned less with outward action and mystery than with the internal monologues of her characters. And she talks not only through the Burgess boys. She also gives us inside views from Helen, Jim's wife, from Pam, Bob's ex-wife, Susan, the little sister, and for brief snatches, even the inner lives of some of the Somali characters. Like Olive Kitteridge, which is really a series of short stories that are tied together by an appearance of Olive in each story, this novel, too, reads like a series of stories, and it seems that each story could have been a novel in its own right. The violence in the story is really limited to the verbal attacks and abusive language of Jim, usually directed towards his adoring younger brother or his abandoned little sister or his unfortunate and naive nephew. It is obvious that Strout has known men like Jim, and even her treatment of him is in the end compassionate. She wants her reader to understand his excesses and provides mitigating, if not exculpating, circumstances for his temper flares. Although this novel has already gotten a lot of press and has been named one of the best books of the year by prestigious journals, I can't say that I would rank it with her Pulitzer winner, Olive Kitteridge. She seems intent on finding and showing some level of development for each of her characters, some form of enlightenment or redemption. For me, this results in a kind of sentimental summing up, a packaging in the end that is a bit too neat, too sweet. That said, I am certainly glad to have read it, and I eagerly await any other offerings she has for us. She's a superb storyteller and a deeply insightful social commentator. There is a goodness and sincerity that literally shines through her work, and there are few who can match her word-weaving skills. I've been talking about Elizabeth Strout's new novel, The Burgess Boys. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
You are tuned to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 in FM in Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host and engineer. If you just tuned in, we heard a little bit from the music of the fracking documentary Gasland. And then before that, Larry Bolden reviewed Elizabeth Strout's new novel, The Burgess Boys. If you tune into KBOO later this morning at 11 on Health Watch with host Dr. David Naiman, he'll be talking with Lynn Clarkson, president of Illinois-based Clarkson Grain and the managing director of Clarkson Soy Products. This segment preempts our previously scheduled interview with Michael Pollan, which had to be canceled. And at 11:30 on the Monday morning radio zine, host Ralph Colson speaks with renowned storyteller, author, and scholar of mythology, anthropology, and psychology, Michael Mead. They'll talk about myth, story, and communities under stress. Up next, Cara Dugas, a newcomer to the Old Mole, brings us The Well-Read Red and a reading from Will Potter's Green is the New Red. She comments on two bills currently in the Oregon Senate, but that have recently passed in the House, House Bills 2595 and 2596. They criminalize nonviolent civil disobedience and direct action by environmentalists.
Hello, my name's Cara Dugas, and I'm a 21-year-old student living in Portland. I'd like to discuss briefly the current issues of criminalizing nonviolent protesting and the targeted labeling of environmentalists and animal rights activists as terrorists. Last month, on April 29th, two bills were passed by the Oregon House that target protesters of clear-cutting and logging of Oregon old-growth forests, House Bills 2595 and 2596. Oregon's Elliott State Forest, home to an endangered seabird, the marbled murrelet, is mentioned specifically in these new bills. Last year, a lawsuit brought by environmentalist groups accused Oregon of violating the Endangered Species Act in defense of the murrelet, which ended up halting logging on hundreds of acres of forest. Now these new bills seek to prevent people from protesting the further destruction of this endangered bird's habitat. Oregon Representative Wayne Krieger carried both bills and has said that they would allow attorneys to, quote, charge these terrorists with a crime and make them accountable, end quote. Similar bills that target undercover factory farm investigators and journalists who later distribute their findings are also being introduced throughout the country alongside terrorist rhetoric. It seems that Krieger and other politicians prefer to persecute individuals rather than addressing the real problems at hand. Protesters can already be charged with crimes under current law, so bills 2595 and 2596 seemingly aim to punish environmentalists more severely for their political beliefs, going so far as to add a Class C felony charge to the list of current criminal charges available. As presented by the House, House Bill 2595 creates the crime of interference with state forest land management in the second and first degrees. For the second degree charge, it makes violations subject to maximum penalty of 1 year's imprisonment, a $6,250 fine, or both. The charge in the first degree makes violations subject to a maximum penalty of 5 years' imprisonment, a $125,000 fine, or both. Both charges require a mandatory minimum of 13 months' imprisonment for just a first conviction and a 5-year imprisonment for subsequent convictions. As mentioned earlier, the crime of interference with state forest land management in the first degree is a Class C felony. The second bill that was passed along these same lines, House Bill 2596, states that a private entity that contracts with the state forestry department has a right of action for the amount of damages against any person that, while on state forest land or an access road, intentionally commits an act that hinders, impairs, or obstructs, or is even an attempt to hinder, impair, or obstruct the performance of the forest practice by the private entity, loggers, for example. These bills have extremely troubling implications. First, the possible heightening of punishment for listed crimes to a Class C felony seems not just far-fetched, but also morally questionable. The Class C felony charge is usually reserved for crimes of violent nature towards other people. Other Class C felonies in Oregon include, among others, negligent homicide, sexual abuse one, child abandonment, incest, bribing a witness, and rape in the third degree. It doesn't seem right that people who are dedicating their time to protecting the environment and other animals should be charged with a felony that is equal to that of assault and abuse. Even if protesters are committing illegal acts of civil disobedience, environmentalist actions aim to protect and raise awareness, not harm anyone. Furthermore, even when property damage by activists takes place, it is still not comparable to violence against people. To reiterate what many people have said before me, corporations are not humans, and damage to funds is not the same as damage to living beings and should therefore not be treated as such. Continuing on to Bill 2596 leads me, and hopefully others, to question the stipulation that people who even so much as attempt to interfere with logging or other private entities can face fines and criminal charges. It also makes me wonder who exactly would determine the amount in damages incurred and whether or not a third independent party would assess the situation before an activist was prosecuted or fined. And what about those of us who would argue that there are things more valuable than any monetary amount? What is the cost or value of saving an endangered species? I would argue that it is much more than the value of damaged tree-cutting equipment or lost revenue. Those things are replaceable. This bill would halt the work of the people who are protecting the endangered murrelet bird in Oregon and allow charges to be brought against activists up to 6 years after their so-called date giving rise to the cause of action. A gap of time that big would allow for potential errors to form and many to forget what actually happened, giving logging companies and others bringing charges a clear upper hand down the line. If these bills are signed into law, we may lose one more endangered species forever, not to mention that it would continue leading us down the historical path of laws that are slowly but surely encroaching upon our First Amendment rights and our struggles to uphold democracy. Before closing, I'd like to address our government's ability to redefine the word terrorist and the negative effects it has had on our country through a short excerpt. from Will Potter's Green is the New Red. This is from a book written by a celebrated journalist who has extensively studied this exact topic and reported on its issues nationally. These concerns have been raised by government agencies and gone unheeded. In 2003, the Justice Department's Office of Inspector General audited the FBI and provided recommendations for improving its terrorism investigations. The audit raised multiple concerns with the Bureau's treatment of animal rights and environmental activists as terrorists. Foremost among them were communications problems within the FBI and the quality of terrorism intelligence sent by the Bureau to state and local law enforcement. The audit revealed that the FBI's weekly intelligence bulletins and quarterly terrorist threat assessments often focused on political activists. The Inspector General recommended that the FBI's intelligence updates focus on, quote, domestic terrorist activities aimed at creating mass casualties or destroying critical infrastructure, rather than information on social protest and domestic radicals' criminal activities. Homeland Security operations have been similarly criticized within Washington. In 2005, U.S. Representative Benny G. Thompson, who is the ranking member on the House Committee on Homeland Security, issued a report with six other committee members criticizing the department for focusing on eco-terrorism while not addressing the threat of right-wing terrorists. Quote, if DHS's long-term planning documents do not consider these and other risks posed by right-wing domestic terrorists, the report said, then lower-level agents working to fight these groups may not be receiving enough budgetary, policy, or administrative support from their superiors. This means possible threats to our homeland could go undetected. Thompson's warning proved astute. There have been a resurgence in right-wing violence. Joseph Stack flew a plane into an IRS building, killing himself and an IRS manager. Members of the self-proclaimed Christian militia Houthi were arrested for allegedly plotting to assassinate federal, state, and local police officers in hopes of sparking an anti-government revolution. An anti-abortion activist murdered Dr. George Tiller. A white supremacist opened fire at the Holocaust Museum, killing one other person before killing himself. In government statements, legal proceedings, and press reports, the word terrorism has been conspicuously absent from any discussion of these crimes. That was from Will Potter's Green is the New Red. Hopefully our government will reassess its priorities in targeting terrorist acts and stop the trend of stripping activists of their First Amendment rights. We need to circulate these concerns and create a force of united people who stand against these new bills. I've been commenting on House Bills 2595 and 2596 that target nonviolent civil disobedience by environmentalists and an excerpt from Will Potter's Green is the New Red. I'm Kara Dugas for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and thanks for listening.
You are tuned to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host and engineer. Just a moment ago, we heard from newcomer to the Old Mole, Kara Dugas, about House Bills 2595 and 2596, which criminalize nonviolent activism by environmentalists interfering with logging operations. The good news is that they have only passed in the House and remain in the Senate. If you'd like to find your state senator to voice your concerns about these bills, we'll provide links to help you find out who your state senator is and how to contact them when the show is posted. Now, Denise Morris talks with Deb Tolman, co-creator of Born This Way, a documentary that's part of the Queer Documentary Film Festival that is the only sort of its kind in this country, happening right here in Portland later this week. Denise?
Thanks, Joe. Yes, Portland's own QDoc celebrates its seventh year with 11 films in 4 days. I have to say it's a very good slate this year, and I hope folks will go out and check out these films. Beginning with the opening night film, I Am Divine, QDoc does what it does best, and it shows quality documentary films, many of them just recently released, And it also gives us an opportunity to talk with directors. Many of them come in to be with us during the screenings and then talk with audience afterwards. And that's always a great opportunity. And it's a great community experience. If you haven't done it before, you should. And if you have, we hope you'll come back out and support this festival. It is one of a kind in, I believe, the world. So it runs Sunday, May 19th. Details can be found online at queerdocfest.org. You'll get all of the films, a possibility of getting tickets for what you need. There's an opening night party as usual. And it, like I said, it's a great slate this year. So I hope folks will come out. One of the films featured this coming weekend is Born This Way. It's directed and produced by Deb Tolman and Sean Cadlick. Born This Way is a feature-length documentary film that explores an underground gay and lesbian community in the West African nation of Cameroon, where homosexuality is punishable by up to 5 years in prison. And Born This Way takes us inside Alternatives Cameroon, the first LGBT center in Cameroon, introducing us to a supportive community on their way to becoming a social movement. I am joined this morning by filmmaker Deb Tolman. Deb, welcome to KBOO.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Yeah, well, we're really happy to have you. I believe of all the years we've done media for QDoc, you are our first filmmaker.
Great.
And we know that you'll also be joining us in Portland over the weekend. The film Born This Way does play on Saturday, I believe, at 2:30. We'll have more details on that later. Deb, you are, the co-founder of Candlefoot Productions, and you've been actually producing documentaries for 8 years. You have a degree in English and theater, and it was really your interest in social justice and visual storytelling that led to your first documentary project in 2005. So fast forward, you and directing partner Sean Cadlick stepped into really new territory with the making of Born This Way. So I wanted to have you start with, you know, how you became aware of these issues in Cameroon and why you decided to make a documentary film.
Yeah, thank you. So Sean and I both had been producing films for long enough to feel like we kind of knew what we were doing, although I have to say that this project has really taken us into a new realm of social issue filmmaking just by its nature. We actually found out about the project through a man, Steve Namande, who's a Cameroonian. He was traveling in the U.S. with Human Rights Watch. And he told us about this center that he had founded where gay and lesbian people were able to not only find sanctuary, but were really just, they sounded like such interesting people to us. So that was what sparked the idea. And we knew neither of us had made a feature-length documentary before. We had done a lot of shorts together and separate. And we knew that it would be different. But in some ways, just the filmmaking itself really became very much a part of the project in the sense that, we went to Cameroon on tourist visas. We, at a certain point, tried to do it officially and to get shooting permits, but that didn't work out. And so really had to do a lot of the filming undercover, under very ambiguous circumstances often, and deal with a lot of danger ourselves. And so our experience as filmmakers really kind of dovetailed with the story that we were telling in some interesting ways. And it was, ultimately we were really humbled by the experience. And, I think that there are a lot of ways that we just didn't know what we were doing or what we were getting ourselves into. And that, I think, also shows up in the film in some positive ways.
Yeah, this film is not, it's not a historical film. It's not a film that relies on expertise to kind of fill in the blanks for the subjects where they're either not prepared or not ready to talk about things in a certain way. But I wanted, before we dig into this a little bit more, I wanted you to talk a little bit more about the historical context, because that is important. And of course, folks have access to so much information. I would really encourage people to take a look at the history of Cameroon and have some understanding of the film or of the circumstances there, because as you said, the circumstances that folks are living with really also informed how you could go about your filmmaking.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. Well, in 1972, I believe, Article 347, the Penal Code was passed, which basically states that, anyone having sexual relations with a person of the same sex, can be arrested for up to 5 years. And it also come to our attention, since we heard about this, that there are actually more arrests for homosexuality in Cameroon than anywhere else in the world. And so just those two facts alone, really give you a sense of or at least sort of spark this curiosity, like, okay, but there is also this, there's this community there. And so what is life like for them? And, as you said, we didn't create an essay film. We created a film that is very much an intimate portrait of two characters' lives. And so there's, but you're right. I mean, in saying that this is the fabric of the society that they're having to deal with, it's just being illegal to be who they are.
So that then leads to the question, what is Alternatives Cameroon and your experience actually going there? I believe you went the first day you were in Cameroon, and as you said, you didn't speak the language well, or very little, but you needed to find subjects. If you were going to make a film, you had to have a subject, yeah. Or subjects.
Yeah. Well, we had been, Alternative Cameroon is, it's an HIV AIDS prevention clinic that also functions somewhat secretly as an LGBT community center. And we had, through the man that we met through Human Rights Watch, Steve Namande, we had connections there. And so we actually had the experience of, being very, white filmmakers, kind of showing up in this African country and knowing that, what we were doing could, be a little bit sketchy, could get us into trouble. And so as we went into this center, we actually, really were surrounded by this community of very welcoming people who knew about the project, who said to us that they were tired of people in Cameroon pretending that gay people don't exist. And so there was an openness that they had from the outset. And what we did is we sat down with probably about a dozen people without cameras and, just had conversations with them about their lives. And from those From those 12 conversations, two people, our two main characters, emerged as having very interesting stories and a kind of charisma and courage and openness about their experience that we felt like would really create a strong foundation for a story, knowing that we really wanted to tell the story through their eyes, not, as you said, not through the voices of experts or a historical overview or any kind of, or from a political activist angle.
Well, and really you're capturing, the opportunity that you had there just is a little mind blowing to me. And I just saw the film yesterday, so I'm still kind of processing things, but this is a group of people who are collecting together and building something to support each other that then you can see that the potential for that is more a social movement, but you're not necessarily documenting a social movement. What you're really capturing is something in the very early stages of evolving from people's consciousness and awareness, but a consciousness and awareness that has operated really underground. And so those next very scary steps are to become more out in public, which is a very frightening thing. As you say, you wanted to capture folks in their day-to-day, in their movements between this safe space, Alternative Cameroon, and the danger of the outside world, which is very evident and real.
Mm-hmm.
So just to kind of talk a little bit about the filmmaking aspect of you talk about the – let me just quote from the director's notes that you say, quote, "The global issues take shape in the background while the daily lives of our subjects, raw, intimate, utterly remarkable, take center stage." And these folks really did make the film what it was. And I wanted to just have you talk about just what that experience was. You say also you both didn't know what kind of film was going to come out of this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, your process in making a documentary is to tell something in some ways to stay as close to truth, if there is mm-hmm. such a thing, as possible, but to be somewhat honest and reflective of the subjects who participate.
Yes, yes. No, that's a great question. And I feel like what we encountered in the filmmaking was this relationship between, you know, documentary filmmaking, which is, you know, really wanting to know and to communicate an idea and to sort of have a very specific story to tell. And then, there's a way that can sort of formulate in the director's mind before even starting the film. But at a certain point can be, in my experience, a hindrance to the actual story that's happening. And this is something that we really just, given how much they were sacrificing in telling their stories or how much they were risking, we really wanted to tell a story that was true rather than some kind of conceptual overview that we thought we knew. And so the way that we kind of structured the film in order to do that was to say, well, let's let this film tell itself in a certain way. Let's let these characters just, you know, kind of unfold before us, and let's follow them wherever they go, and not know exactly where the story is going to take us. And you know, there's a scene in the film, just this is just an example, where, you know, we went to one of our subjects' houses to interview her, and, you know, just a harrowing day. I won't get into the details, but when we get there, you know, we kind of set up the lights and get ready for the interview, and the power goes out. Mm-hmm. And then Gertrude sort of lights a match and starts lighting candles around the room, and the scene that kind of wanted to happen was this candlelit scene shot in silhouette so that her girlfriend who was there didn't have to have her face shown on camera, which was her preference. And the two of them just interacted and sort of started telling stories about their lives that we hadn't known had even happened to them. You know, these very intimate and real stories. And so this is just one example of how...
I need to actually end us here because we're coming up at end of the hour. But that is a great example, and it's one of the most moving scenes. And I love that it happened as you describe it. Deb Tolman, your film Born This Way plays Q-Doc this weekend on Saturday at 2:30. Thank you so much for coming and talking with us. And folks should come out and see the film and continue this conversation at Q-Doc.
Yeah, thanks so much, Denise. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Denise and Deb Tolman. I'd like to also say that after you go to QDoc, all this month, the Portland Playhouse, in collaboration with Hand to Mouth Theater, is putting on a stage adaptation of Ursula K. Le Guin's The Left Hand of Darkness. It runs through June 2nd. Showings are in the evening on Thursdays through Saturdays, with matinee showings on the weekends. Google Left Hand of Darkness, Portland Playhouse, for ticket information. And that is all the time we have for today. Thanks to Bill Resnick, who spoke with Megan Heiss and Seamus Cook about the People's Budget Project. Don't forget that this 16th at 5 p.m., there will be a People's Potluck down in front of City Hall and an opportunity for citizens to speak up for alternatives to austerity in the city's budget. Thanks to Larry Bolden for his review of Elizabeth Strout's new novel, The Burgess Boys. Special thanks to newcomer Kara Dugas for her commentary on Oregon House Bills 2595 and 2596, and reading from Will Potter's Green is the New Red. You can listen to this show or any part of it again when we post it to the KBOO website. The best way to find it is to either friend us on Facebook or email the Old Mole at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com with a request for the URL. You can also send your feedback, questions, suggestions for new content, or a request to revisit a topic or guest. Tune in next week for more news, reviews, interviews, commentary, and analysis from the Mole's radical perspective. For the Old Mole Variety Hour and KBOO 90.7 FM, this has been Joe Clement. Well, coming up next on KBOO, it's Air Cascadia with locally produced news, interviews, and just plain horse sense with Chris Andre. At 10:15, we'll hear Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's guest is a Seattle-based writer and senior editor of Yes Magazine, Madeline Ostrander, author of a recent article about cap and trade, which claims that the program merely allows large corporations to buy their way out of responsible behavior towards climate-damaging emissions.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Monday, May 13th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Saturday morning at the Memorial Coliseum, David Suzuki tore into Governor Kitzhaber. Kitzhaber quoted Thomas Pynchon from Gravity's Rainbow, and the Dalai Lama laughed at his own jokes. Students from colleges throughout the New York metropolitan area are calling for TIAA-CREF to divest from all companies benefiting from the Israeli occupation of Palestine. This divestment campaign is enormous. We are going to be speaking with Elena Krivo-Kaufman at the center of the movement a little bit later in the show. And this, Jerry Cope, a New York City anarchist and legal activist, has been subpoenaed for the second time to a federal grand jury investigating the same event. We used to call that double jeopardy. And let's not forget that the 16th coming up, May 15th marks 65 years since the Nakba, the dispossession, the forced exile, and the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians began. First, this from the National Weather Service. Showers today, highs near 66, and we've got a bit of a breeze, southwest wind 7 to 15, gusting up to 24. Tonight, look for more showers early on, overcast, lows around 49, and west southwest winds 10 to 15. It is going to get breezy this evening. could have gusts up to 24 miles per hour for tomorrow. Those winds, it could partly clear the skies. We've got a bit of sun, a high around 68, calm winds, and for Tuesday night, overcast with a low around 50. Alternative forecast, waxing crescent, flower moon in Gemini is 3 days old, the synodic forecast. Leafy vegetables, people, and annuals produced above ground. If you're going to try grains, this is the moment to get that in the ground, and it's not a good time to pick vegetables to be stored. And why would you at this time of year? Biodynamic outlook moon in Gemini, air sign. It's a good time for flowering plants. The sidereal forecast moon in Gemini, they say that it's a good time for promoting flower growth, though otherwise generally barren and dry. And that's it for both the conventional and the alternative forecasts. We want to get right into it today because we do have a guest who's going to be joining us in a little while. But first this, as if you have not heard yet, on May 9th, for the first time ever, the carbon dioxide counter on the side of Mauna Loa, the most important scientific instrument on Earth, recorded a daily average of above 400 parts per million. It's a grim landmark. It's been several million years since CO2 reached these levels in the atmosphere. That's 400 parts per million. And the next day in Portland, the 10th, the Dalai Lama was in town talking about climate change, environmental catastrophe, and the hazards of limitless growth, which the governor apparently felt could be balanced with environmental concerns. That in itself, of course, is a concern. The Dalai Lama, he did kick off his four-day visit to Portland a bit earlier. He talked about his understanding of pollution. He, interestingly enough, Dalai Lama says that he came to environmental environmental awareness through water. He was visiting India, and he was told you can't drink the water because it's not good for you, it's polluted.